A plea to Governor Abbott as COVID cases set new records in Texas. Do more to curb the spread or let us take steps to do it. The latest coming up on today's Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. A return to stay-at-home orders? That's one thing leaders in Travis County are asking for the power to enforce as hospitalization rates in and around the Texas capital city approach 70%. Also, the pandemic sparks extended food benefits for millions of Texas kids. Though the current plan is for many Texas schools to reopen in the fall, many teachers may not be in the classroom. We'll hear why, plus a whole lot more, when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 30th day of June 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us and hope your Tuesday's going well. Alas, things are definitely not going well right now in the fight against the spread of the coronavirus in Texas. In parts of the state, positive case counts are setting new records again this week. That includes Austin's home county of Travis, where hospital capacity now approaches 70%. That according to Sam Bisco, who is interim Travis County judge, one of several local officials statewide who have reached out to Governor Greg Abbott in recent days asking him to take further steps to order mandatory use of face masks, impose tighter restrictions on social gatherings, roll back business occupancy more than he did on Friday, or if he is unwilling to do so, allow local officials to step in. The letter also asks the governor to let major metro areas roll all the way back to stay-at-home orders, quote, based on worsening circumstances. In summary, Judge Bisco's letter goes on to say, the rapid increase in cases has outstripped our ability to track, measure, and mitigate the spread of the disease. Sarah Eckhart is a special assistant to Travis County Judge Sam Bisco, a former Travis County judge herself. She officially stepped down recently from the post to run in a special election for a state Senate seat. Ms. Eckhart, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
I understand that you were involved in helping to put this letter together. Tell us a little bit about what's behind this level of alarm among Travis County and city leaders that would push them to make this request from Governor Abbott.
Well, we began to see some pretty significant spikes in cases at the end of last week, which precipitated a lot of conversation among the major metropolitan county judges and mayors. And so we were seeing really, really difficult circumstances in Harris and Houston. And so in conversation, we all reached out to the governor's office, and the governor's office reached back and said, give me all your statistics and tell me what you want. And so we began working on letters all across the state in Harris, Dallas, Tarrant, Bexar County, El Paso County, Travis County, to provide the governor with our status update and what we would request in order to flatten this curve.
One line that stands out in this letter is this possibility of a return to stay-at-home orders. If the county were able to issue another stay-at-home order, what would that look like? Are we talking about sanctions for those who refuse to do so, or what exactly? A complete shutdown of business? How do you see it playing out?
I think that what's envisioned is that we would go back to what we did before, which worked, which was almost a mirror image across the major metropolitan counties, as well as the surrounding counties, did flatten our curve and slow the progress of the virus so that we could prepare our hospitals, get enough personal protective equipment, analyze how many ventilators we would need, how much personnel we would need. And that really helped a tremendous amount. And it certainly saved lives. So we would very much like to avoid shutting back down, but when you open precipitously, when you open all the way back up, you roll back the gains that you made from the first stay home, work safe. So what we were trying to avoid, what we were trying to get to actually, was an adaptive reopening that would be phased, that would be based on data and the numbers of infections that we were seeing on the ground. But that's not what happened. We opened based on a political calendar rather than on the medical science. And that's what's causing us to contemplate going back to a stay home, work safe.
You know, I read online a lot of people saying this would be a bit like trying to shut the stable door after the horse is bolted, though. How do you respond to concerns that maybe it's too late to try to roll things back?
I think that that is a failure to recognize the generosity and the adaptability of the human species. I think when you're faced with a existential threat, like a viral infection for which there is no vaccine, that has a very high mortality rate, specifically among our over 65 population, as high as a 20 to 25% mortality rate in older Americans. We've already experienced 121 deaths just locally. If that had been a chemical spill on I-35 causing 121 deaths, I think people would take notice and want to do something about it. It's a matter of saving lives.
Forgive me for interrupting, but we're already seeing bar owners, for example, who have formed a lawsuit against the state saying you're picking and choosing. You're saying that we have to shut down. Other businesses are allowed to stay open. I can only imagine that such an order, if we were to reverse back to late March, early April, you would see a stack of lawsuits. You would see a pushback in many large ways. Is that a concern, and how much should it be a concern?
I think that there's great turmoil right now and a tremendous amount of uncertainty. And so, yes, there's certainly going to be some controversy over it. But I think that by sticking with medical science and the data, it becomes pretty apparent what is risky behavior and what is not. What are industries that are adapting and are able to adapt, and which ones are not? These are just facts. They're not picking and choosing. The virus is picking and choosing.
Sarah Eckhart is a special assistant to Travis County Judge Sam Bisco, a former Travis County judge herself, who recently stepped down from the post to run for a special election for a state Senate seat. Ms. Eckhart, thanks so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's the second day of early voting in the primary runoffs and the second day of our close-up on some high-profile races. Yesterday, we introduced you to one of the two Democrats hoping to challenge U.S. Senator John Cornyn in November. Today, we turn to the person considered by many to be the front-runner in the race, M.J. Hager. You may recall Hager ran a closely watched campaign for Congress in 2018 when a wave of women ran for office following the Me Too movement. KUT Austin's Ashley Lopez has more.
MJ Hager's political career began about 3 years ago when she announced she was running for Congress against Austin area Republican incumbent John Carter. And it all started with an ad.
This is a story about doors. A lot of them.
Hager's ad told the story of her career as an Air Force pilot, her childhood, and her fight to get women the ability to serve in combat roles in the military. The ad was fast-paced, moving, and featured Hager as this no-nonsense fighter who had had it with her local congressman. It got a lot of attention.
A former Air Force combat veteran running for Congress in Texas, and MJ Hager, her latest ad has gone viral with nearly 2 million views in just 5 days.
Hager ended up losing to Carter by less than 3 percentage points in the 2018 election. Just to compare, in 2016, Carter won his election by more than 20 points. The election before that, he won by more than 30. Hager was part of a wave of women seeking office during that midterm election, the first since the Me Too movement, when many women were speaking out against harassment, sexual violence, and discrimination. That last one's something Hager deeply cares about because of a medical mission she flew in Afghanistan.
In my third tour, I was shot down and had to engage the enemy in ground combat in order to help rescue my crew and patients.
Hager says it was a group effort, but they got out. Everyone survived.
And that experience made me one of the lead voices in the fight to open ground combat jobs for women. Women were in ground combat, but they weren't allowed to officially serve in the roles that, you know, are considered the primary ground mission roles.
Hager says it was hurting the military.
It was tying the hands of the commanders in the field, and I agreed to take on that fight, even though it meant the end of my pilot career, because, you know, you don't we don't have the right to organize. We don't have unions in the military. So when you sue the Secretary of Defense, you're pretty much ending your military career.
But in 2012, that's what Hagar did. Sued the Pentagon. She shifted her career to healthcare and stayed committed to getting the military to change its policy on women in ground combat roles. Hagar says most of the pushback she got didn't come from the military. It came from politicians in D.C.
So that's when I had to become more active politically. And I think a lot of Texans find a distaste for politics, and I was one of them.
So Hagar and a colonel in the Army created a kind of lobbying group. She says they recruited 25 female combat vets who were really frustrated with the military's policy. They knocked on doors and lobbied members of Congress.
You know, we didn't raise money and pay ourselves a salary. We just took time off work and went to D.C. and talked to as many senators and congressmen and women and staffers as possible.
They eventually won this fight, but Hagar says it was hard to get politicians to talk to her. The experience, she says, taught her how D.C. works. Unless you're a moneyed special interest, it's hard to get lawmakers' attention.
It seems like they are more focused on getting reelected and serving their corporate donors and their profit margins.
Hagar decided to run for office in the 2018 election. In particular, she chose to run against her own congressman, one of those politicians who wouldn't hear her out. Now, in her run for U.S. Senate, Hagar's stressing she understands what families in Texas are going through, especially these days, because she's raising a family here herself.
I have a 3 and a 5-year-old. And so when I look at them and I look at the world they're growing up into, and I look at the impact of climate change and the impact of the gun violence epidemic.
Hagar says that all makes her wonder whether her kids will have access to things like quality education and healthcare. She says she's making those things her next fight. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Wells Dunbar's monitoring social media on this Tuesday. Hello there, Wells.
Hi, David. We're keeping an eye on new coronavirus news across the state. Texas grocer HEB responding to increasing demand in its stores as the COVID-19 spike builds by reimposing some limits on purchases. On his Facebook page, State Representative Terry Canales writes, "There's nothing more Texan than HEB having to put limits on the amount of brisket we can buy, along with hand sanitizer and toilet paper." Indeed, slabs of brisket being one of those limited items. And as the pandemic continues, many voicing concern about the Texas GOP convention, an in-person masks optional event set to start in just over 2 weeks in outbreak hotspot Houston. On our Facebook page, Cynthia Sponhell says she's just learning that the Texas Medical Association is one of the sponsors of the GOP convention, what she calls an event with a high COVID super spreader potential in an urban area on the brink of being an epicenter of the COVID infection in the U.S. Just a couple of the stories we're keeping an eye on today, David, and you know, I'll be back with more later in the show.
In about 35 minutes or so, reach out to us in the meantime and let us hear from you, Texas. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town. Tours with social distancing at Moody Mansion, Bryan Museum, and Bishop's Palace. More at galveston.com. It's Island Time with safety in mind.
Business and Your Money on the Standard. I'm David Brown. Texans with children who qualify for free and reduced price school lunches have an extra month to apply for a pandemic food benefit program. It's called the Pandemic EBT, or Electronic Benefit Transfer. KERA's Christopher Connolly reports more than 3 million Texas kids qualify for the help to buy groceries.
The extra money will come as a one-time payment of $285 per child to help lower-income families cover the cost of extra meals kids ate at home because schools were closed. Parents and guardians of school kids who get free and reduced-price meals can get the money loaded onto a pandemic EBT card when they enroll in the program. School districts were directed to send out information to eligible families in May. Those families now have until the end of July to apply. Governor Greg Abbott's office says nearly $700 million in pandemic EBT funds have been distributed to families of about 2.5 million Texas children. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
A note here, parents of eligible kids who already get food stamps or SNAP benefits from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program should have had the money automatically loaded onto their Lone Star cards.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. As we mentioned a bit earlier in the broadcast, daily COVID-19 cases have been hitting new peaks across Texas as more establishments open for business. In the heart of the Texas Hill Country, Fredericksburg relies in large part on well-to-do tourists who like to escape the big cities. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh visited Fredericksburg twice recently to see how the town is trying to work out its new normal.
I drove to Fredericksburg before the reports of increased coronavirus cases in the state. I called the Visitor and Convention Bureau to see if the area was open for business.
Yes, actually.
Amanda Kuhn is the Bureau's Director of Communication. She says Fredericksburg has moved into the recovery phase and is doing a soft marketing push out of respect for the local community of about 11,000 residents.
As far as marketing materials go and pushing messaging, up until this point, we've been silent. We just didn't feel like it was an appropriate time to market visitation to Fredericksburg.
They didn't need to. Visitation started to pick up by Memorial Day weekend. The Gillespie County Airport in Fredericksburg never closed, but more and more visitors were flying in on tiny prop planes from Houston, Dallas, and other major cities. Gwen Fulbrook runs a flight school at the airport. She also owns a mortgage company and a bed and breakfast closer to downtown. Her bed and breakfast saw a wave of cancellations in March.
Well, just people started calling and canceling and emailing and canceling, and it was the same way with every place in town. And it was just bizarre.
She says weekends are still slow at the bed and breakfast, but she did see an uptick over the holiday weekend. Lodging may be slow in Fredericksburg, but Central Main Street was bustling. Most of the shops and restaurants were open.
Oh, busy, busy, busy.
Michelle Sandoval works at a place called Heirlooms, Needless Necessities. The non-essential store followed orders and shut down in mid-March. Sandoval says only one of the seven employees returned to work, so she took one of the open jobs.
We sanitize, we keep ourselves clean, we distance ourselves.
But the store doesn't require employees or shoppers to wear masks. Most of the tourists I saw walking down Main Street didn't wear them either, even though a large sign flashed, "Wear a mask and practice social distancing."
Okay.
I went back to see if the recent reports of climbing COVID numbers in Texas had an effect on visitors here.
Hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
Most tourists were still maskless, including Rose Preston from Denton. She was here for her 33rd wedding anniversary.
Oh, I'm not over it. I feel for people who get it, but I just didn't buy into the whole shutting down everything. The flu kills more people every year than this has.
Not true. The flu kills up to 61,000 people a year in the U.S., according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. COVID-19 deaths are double that number. Gillespie County is not a COVID-19 hotspot, but visitors come from other areas that are, and that worries local business owners.
They can bring it with them. That's something everybody's worried about.
Randy Peel runs a peach stand on the far southeast side of town. You can get some of the best peaches in the state here in Fredericksburg.
$39.75.
Peel has made a lot of adjustments to keep her staff and patrons safe. They are not required to wear masks, but Peel has put up plastic partitions, and customers aren't allowed to handle the produce before purchase. Randy Peel's parents opened the stand when she was 15.
52 years, we did it one way. Now we're doing it a completely different way.
Das Peach House, another family-owned fruit vendor in Fredericksburg, is taking a lot more precaution.
So we got 96.8.
Employee temperatures are checked as they enter and leave every day, and everyone is required to wear a mask. But the place that is probably the most strict here is the National Museum of the Pacific War. It's full of historic artifacts from World War II, including a Japanese submarine captured near Pearl Harbor. The museum estimates it lost about $300,000 by shutting down in March.
Obviously, we thrive on our visitation here on site.
Rory Cartier is the museum's director.
So most of our operational budget relies on on-site revenue from admissions. And we pull from all over the state all over Texas, and then all across the country as well.
The museum is now open, but reservations are required and limited to small groups, and everyone inside is required to wear a mask. About 300 visitors came every day in peak season before the pandemic. Visitation is about a tenth of that now, mostly by design. Mark Wisser's family owns Das Peach House, that business that takes employee temperatures every day. He says the pandemic reminds him of stories from his mother, who survived another global pandemic a century ago.
And I remember her telling me that entire families died within a week. Five people, all gone. And I guess you can go to the cemetery and read the tombstones of families that caught that flu, the Spanish flu, and died. So in some sense, the idea of a pandemic was very real to us because I knew people who had experienced it here.
Wisser says that if any employee tests positive for COVID-19 or even shows symptoms, he will shut down the business for at least 2 weeks. And no one wants that. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in the Texas Hill Country.
There are 33 confirmed COVID-19 cases in Gillespie County, including a recent cluster of three in a nursing home. So far, there are no deaths. A county press release about the nursing home cases listed several steps to mitigate the spread. It did not mention masks. Experts say face coverings are one of the most effective tools in the fight against COVID-19. A few more details about a story we mentioned earlier, a pushback against Governor Abbott's order to close bars. The Texas Tribune reports that more than 30 bar owners across the state have joined a lawsuit filed in Travis County by Houston attorney Jared Woodfill. It argues that Abbott's order issued last Friday, quote, tramples their rights, sentencing bar owners to bankruptcy. Governor Abbott hasn't admitted many missteps during this pandemic, but in an interview with an El Paso TV station, he did admit, quote, if I could go back and redo anything, it probably would have been to slow down the opening of bars. The governor says his new orders are essential to curb COVID cases, which have been surging in recent weeks. 29 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, helping patients fight cancer with telemedicine. Virtual online appointments are available for patients to continue their cancer journey while practicing safe social distancing. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. What Texas public school students should learn about contraception, abortion, and LGBTQ issues was the focus of an hours-long public hearing the State Board of Education held Monday. As KUT's Nathan Bernier reports, it's the first time state officials are overhauling health education guidelines in more than 20 years.
Texas has the seventh highest rate of teen births in the country, according to the CDC. Jasmine Robinson, a former teen mom herself, told the board that she wished she had been taught in school about how to prevent unintended pregnancy.
Youth are going to engage in sex regardless if they are informed or not. And when they are not educated, then we are doing the youth a disservice.
Monica Layel Klein worked as a street health educator for a decade in Austin, teaching comprehensive sex education, but told the board she ultimately came to believe that it pressures kids to have sex.
Parents should be educated and have these conversations with their children at home, but it should be at their child's pace and not forced on them by a mandate in our public schools.
A final vote by the State Board of Education is set for November. I'm Nathan Bernier in Austin.
Two congressmen from the Rio Grande Valley are asking Governor Greg Abbott to send the National Guard to the region to help healthcare workers confront a surge in coronavirus cases. As Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leaños Jr. reports, the Democrats sent the letter Monday.
In the letter, Congressman Fili Monvela and Congressman Vicente Gonzalez say that in counties along the U.S.-Mexico border, the demand for ICU beds has surpassed capacity. The letter also says ICUs and emergency rooms in the Rio Grande Valley are lacking space for COVID-19 patients, but new patients are arriving at high rates. The congressmen call on the establishment of field hospitals and the deployment of military personnel to prevent a humanitarian crisis along the border. The letter asks Abbott to work with the White House to withdraw the more than 5,000 troops at the border who are there for border protection and instead use them to provide medical support. The congressmen call it an emergency situation. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Mission.
A staff member for the Texas Juvenile Justice Department has died of COVID-19. Sean Wilson was with the agency since 2014. He was a youth development coach at the Giddings State School in Lee County. Wilson was diagnosed with the virus on June 22nd and died 6 days later at his home. 25 TJJD staff members and 16 detained youths have tested positive for the virus. The state agency says as of yesterday, more than 240 young people in their facilities have been screened for the virus. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
As communities grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, new developments unfold continuously. Catch up on the day's news from around the world and across Texas by listening to All Things Considered, weekday afternoons on your local NPR station.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. There was a time when you couldn't find black bears in West Texas. They're native to the area, but unregulated hunting and habitat loss more or less pushed them out. But over the past few decades, bears have come back in a big way west of the Pecos. Just here and there at first, but now they're in many places. Just ask folks in Alpine or Fort Davis or Fort Stockton, all places where there have been bear sightings earlier this month. Here to tell us more, James Weaver. He's a technical guidance biologist with the Trans-Pecos Division of Texas Parks and Wildlife. Mr. Weaver, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, sir. Good to be here.
There are folks who have lived their whole lives in far west Texas and never seen a bear until the last few years. What's behind this sudden uptick in sightings?
You know, I think it's just a trend. Trend in bear sightings kind of started to indicate that the bears are making a comeback to west Texas and recolonizing some of their formerly occupied habitat, such as the Davis Mountains. I think it's just taking a while to get to where we are, and bears are native here. They've been here longer than people. They're supposed to be here, you know. And so, yeah, those bears are just finding some of this unoccupied habitat, and they're just moving back in.
So when you say unoccupied habitat, I understand that there are stories of bear sightings in some developed areas. What are they doing? Walking up to windows and looking in, or what?
Yes, sir. Unoccupied habitat. I'm talking about, you know, just habitat that is void of bears. That's been that way, you know, for many years. And some of these recent ones, like you're talking about, I really think that's pretty well tied to dry times of the year. So we usually see an uptick in those sightings all in the fall, like in November, when it kind of starts to get dry and those food sources start to dwindle. Same thing with here recently. It's been a pretty dry spring in 2020, and so I think that's pushing some of those bears into basically urban areas with people and towns in search for food. So I think that's a big factor in some of these recent sightings.
Someone told me that there was a bear sighting in downtown Fort Davis. Is that true?
Yes, sir. Yeah, we've got my phone was blowing up. We got all kinds of videos and pictures when everybody was seeing him, and they saw him that evening, and we kind of stayed on the lookout for him and haven't received any other reports. So hopefully he moved on, and that's what we want. That's what we want to happen. We want those bears. We don't want them in town, because that could definitely create some problems and some conflicts with people and pets and that sort of deal. So just that one evening, he wandered into town. Looked like a younger bear, but like I say, he probably smelled something he liked and come in looking for something to eat.
So what can people who live out in far west Texas do to keep bears from, say, invading their territory or their homestead or what have you?
Yeah, the main source of human-bear conflicts usually comes from some kind of food source. So basically, preventing these conflicts, you got to secure those attractants, those food sources, that garbage, you know, keep that garbage indoors until the morning of trash pickup and then put it out there. That just kind of keeps that door closed on that bear getting that until that morning. That shortens that window for him to find that, basically that garbage. Same thing with, you know, pet food, keeping it where it's stored in a locked up building or something where a bear can't get to it. Deer feeders or other wildlife feeders, we put hot wire electrical fencing around deer feeders and things like that. So removing those food sources is the best way to do that. And a lot of times those preventative measures, you know, they do come at a cost. We realize that. And times are tough right now, especially with all this stuff that we're facing. But I think overall, the risk of not doing anything is going to far outweigh the cost of doing something.
How are locals adapting? I mean, as these stories sort of spread by word of mouth and in the local paper, what are you noticing?
You know, people are reaching out to us looking for advice to basically get these bears away from houses and away from deer feeders and things like that to save, you know, cost to them getting their stuff tore up, their houses tore up or whatever. So basically just reaching out. I've seen more and more people reach out and tell me stories. Hey, we've got bears, looking for information on how to deter bears and keep bears away. That's the biggest thing I've seen, just an uptick in sightings. And just more people reaching out, trying to determine what they can do to live with bears. And just going forward, it's just going to, I think it's going to become more and more normal, you know, for us. So,
James Weaver is a technical guidance biologist with the Trans-Pecos Division of Texas Parks and Wildlife. Mr. Weaver, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir, for having me.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texas is planning to reopen schools with in-person instruction in the fall, but many teachers may not be there. As many as 1 in 5 U.S. educators say they're unlikely to return to the classroom because of the coronavirus. That's according to national surveys conducted before Texas leaders indicated a light-handed approach to safety guidelines. It's put many on edge, and some Houston teachers are seriously considering leaving the classroom, as Houston Public Media's Laura Isensee reports.
For 40 years, Robin Stauffer has taught high school English, most recently in Katy. She says working with kids has kept her young and lighthearted. But since the pandemic hit, a question nagged at her. Was it time to retire?
I was very upset and sad. I was torn. I went back and forth.
On the one hand, she wasn't ready. She's still passionate about why she joined the profession in the first place.
To be the type of teacher that I wish I would have had when I was in public school, to kind of right the wrongs that I experienced.
On the other hand, since her district cut custodial staff, it was often up to teachers to clean their own rooms.
They don't supply hand sanitizer. They don't supply wipes. None of these supplies were ever given to us. You just use what you had or what teachers themselves purchase.
Stauffer waited for the Katy Independent School District to release safety plans for back to school. Instead, she's seen a back to normal attitude. And then there's her health. She's 66 years old, has diabetes, and a family history of heart disease. It all makes her more vulnerable to the coronavirus.
I just don't trust the school district to safeguard my health during this pandemic.
Like Stauffer, nearly one-third of U.S. teachers are 50 years or older, according to federal data. And the publication Education Week has identified over 300 school staff and retired educators who've died from COVID-19.
There's obviously a lot of fear, mostly because there are so many unanswered questions.
Noel Candelaria leads the Texas State Teachers Association. He says staff with underlying health conditions are also concerned. Take his own family. Candelaria is married to Patty, a dyslexia therapist. She's had 3 surgeries to fix a congenital heart defect.
There are educators like my wife who, if the districts do not provide an alternative method for them to be able to, you know, still do their job from home without exposing themselves, that are seriously considering a medical leave.
School districts are still waiting for safety guidelines from the Texas Education Agency. So far, Governor Greg Abbott has indicated schools won't have to require face masks or test for COVID symptoms. That worries Kristen McClintock. She teaches special education at a large Houston high school.
It was really shocking because it just seems like nobody cares what's going to happen in the schools.
She and her husband have discussed her quitting and staying at home with their young children.
It would cut our finances in half. We would have to lean on support, probably from family, to try and get by.
McClintock is still deciding, but veteran educator Robin Stauffer has made up her mind. She turned in her resignation in May.
All my life, I've been a teacher. That is who I am. And to give up my identity, you know, it will be challenging, but I don't feel like I had another choice.
She said goodbye to students over Zoom and didn't have any real celebration. Until some of her colleagues surprised her with a car parade, a very COVID way to end a 40-year career. In Houston, I'm Laura Eisensee.
Hospitalized COVID-19 patients are isolated from family and friends. So at Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas, doctors are using technology to bridge this emotional divide. KERA contributor Sujatha Dand reports virtual communication is also changing the way doctors work with each other.
Their baby was only 4 months old when Katrina Parks found out her husband was going to be put on a ventilator after testing positive for COVID-19. She FaceTimed him just before he was intubated.
I just told him that I loved him, and I told him, please just make sure you come back home to me.
Minutes later, Parks found out her infant daughter had also tested positive.
This was the worst day of my life. I was afraid, especially for my husband, because I couldn't see my husband. So I cried, and then I said, okay. So what do we do and how do we fix this?
Parks was allowed to stay with her daughter, who recovered after about a week. But her husband was much sicker and was isolated in the COVID unit at Parkland Hospital. Parkland, like most hospitals across the country, doesn't allow family members to visit COVID patients. Dr. Padmaja Reddy is a palliative care physician at Parkland.
You know, I think any illness happens to a family, not just to a patient. But the separation makes this especially hard on families.
Reddy believes it's critical for a patient's recovery to be near loved ones. As COVID-19 started to spread in North Texas, she developed a plan using Zoom to make sure family members like Parks could connect virtually to patients.
I had this horrible doomsday picture in my head. So whenever I got to see him, I looked at him and I said, oh my goodness, he looks so great. I was so happy to be able to see him.
Dr. Reddy says Parkland's new COVID protocol also uses Zoom to connect doctors, like infectious disease specialists and cardiologists, virtually, with staff at the bedside, like nurses and pulmonologists.
16 big faces lined up like the Brady Bunch on a screen, and everybody talks together and puts their best ideas forward, comes to a consensus, and then we move on from there.
Generally, physicians and staff check on patients independently, then leave notes for each other. Reddy says the flexibility technology offers is often more efficient and better for patients.
We had a patient who came in, and yes, they had COVID affecting the lungs, but they also had serious heart problems. And so in minutes, we were able to text our colleagues, get them the Zoom information, and there they were, looking at the patient. I don't really know if this is going to carry forward post-COVID, but I really hope it does.
Internal medicine residents have gotten in on the Zoom calls, too. They round virtually in the mornings and have dedicated time in the afternoons to keep families updated on a patient's progress. Katrina Parks, as a resident, would also coordinate calls with COVID nurses so she could speak to her husband while he was on the ventilator.
Every day that he was gone and in the hospital, I left the light on in our room. So every day that I talked to him, I told him, hey, I am waiting for you to come home and turn the light off, hoping, honestly, that he could hear and just know that we love him and that we miss him and care for him.
After being on the ventilator for 21 days, Carrie Parks was able to breathe on his own. The first person he remembers seeing was his wife on Zoom.
Oh, man. Oh, That was something else. You know, seeing her face, seeing my daughter, you know, it just like, you know, it's just an indescribable feeling.
He was like mouthing to me, baby, baby. And so I held the baby up into the Zoom picture, and then he just started bawling. And I was just like, oh my goodness. I'm just so thankful because like it's gonna be okay.
After nearly a month in the hospital, Parks finally came home. He got to hold his baby and turn off the bedroom lights. I'm Sujatha Dand in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. COVID-19 has affected a whole lot of everyday life, and it's also certain to change things for Texas lawmakers who will begin their 87th session starting in January. But how things will change, well, that's a trickier question. If stay-at-home and social distancing guidelines remain in place, governing in the state capitol will likely look a lot different for Texas's 150 state House representatives and 31 state senators. Ross Ramsey's been keeping tabs on how the next legislative session could shape up under such circumstances. He's the executive editor and co-founder of the Texas Tribune. Ross, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me, David.
San Antonio area Republican State Representative Lyle Larson posted a photo on Twitter last week showing plastic dividers between some chairs where lawmakers sit on the House floor. A sign of things to come?
You know, I think so. I mean, it's going to be like the salad screens at a restaurant. You know, they want to keep the members separated. You know, the floor of the House is a really good example of this. It's a big, big room. But there are 150 members. There's probably 40 staffers in there at any given time. And that's before Wow. You add press or lobby or public or any of that. And just the logistics of the room say you can't get everybody 6 feet apart. So you got to put shields between them, potentially. They're looking at those right now. And that's what Larson posted up. And they're trying to figure out how to conduct a government, which is basically a big social event, you know, a legislative session, a big social event without getting anybody infected.
I was going to say, anyone who's ever been to the state capitol during a session knows just how much hullabaloo is going on, you know, both inside the chambers and outside. And you mentioned all the staffers. What are lawmakers talking about when it comes to how they're going to maintain social distancing, when it comes to everyday legislative procedures?
The building holds about 6,000 people when it's, you know, really rolling and the public's in there and the legislature's in there and all of that. So the first thing is they're going to have to cut the number of people that come in. There's a question of how much of the public can come in, whether we're going to be watching them sitting in committee rooms or in the galleries of the House and Senate, or probably, you know, more likely on TV or on our laptops or something from outside. The staffers are in there all the time. You've got to do things to the offices to keep them safe. You're going to have rules around elevators. It's just not what the building was built for.
Is there someone who is ultimately in charge of implementing all these changes? Who does that fall to?
You know, the governor really has the say on what's open and when, but the State Preservation Board runs kind of the day-to-day stuff in the Capitol. And then on the House side, the Administration Committee of the House, the Administration Committee of the Senate, and the Secretary of the Senate kind of have the day-to-day mechanics of it.
You know, a lot of business, everyday business, has gone to Zoom and other sort of distancing platforms online. Is it conceivable? Is it possible? Is it legal for lawmakers to try to conduct some of their business online? Can you vote, for example, without being there in the Senate or House chambers?
Not under the current rules. Now, you can always change the rules, but you have to be there to change the rules. So, you know, what you're probably looking at if they're going to do something like that is they come in, first order of business is always let's pass the new rules, let's elect a speaker, all of that kind of stuff. And you could include in those rules provisions for how to conduct a virtual committee hearing, how to conduct a vote, you know, how do you satisfy open meetings law while you're not allowing people in the room to the meeting? There's a bunch of stuff to think about, but, you know, the advantage is they've got a little bit of time. They don't come in until January.
I was trying to think if there is any sort of precedent for the sort of steps that lawmakers will have to take here. Can you think of any precedent for this?
You know, not off the top of my head. I mean, you know, the a lot of city governments, a lot of county governments have provisions in their rules that allow virtual meetings. So you've probably seen, you know, maybe a school board or something like that. The legislature just needs to put those things in place. It has always been a live event, and it's designed, you know, that building is built for fighting it. So people can go in there and holler at each other and debate and figure out what they want to do. And you're removing that social situation, you know, where you're actually in a room looking at each other debating something. So it's going to be very peculiar. I'm not sure there is a precedent.
Ross Ramsey is executive editor and co-founder of the Texas Tribune. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Ross, thanks again.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again, it's Wells Dunbar. He is our social media editor. What do you see on social media today there, Wells?
Hey, David. Well, you know, it takes a lot to cut through the COVID-19 news out there, but this story seems to have done it. What's been described as Russian-paid bounties on American troops in Afghanistan paid to members of the Taliban. If you've been listening to your public radio station, you've no doubt heard some of the details, the fact that this information was allegedly related to the president in his daily briefings and by other members of his staff, but yet he elected not to act upon it. Our listeners have lots of thoughts about this. As you may expect, Mickey Shanahan, via our Facebook page, says he's eager to find out what the truth is behind this story of Russian bounties on American soldiers. If it really is the case, as the president says, that the intelligence community didn't believe the reports were credible, or did Trump even actually know, referring to this sort of ongoing issue of whether or not the president did receive it, or even, you know, we've seen some other reporting, David, that the president does receive these briefings, but basically doesn't pay attention to them. So, I mean, that could be another sort of option here as well. Leah Keese brings up another interesting fact. She says the fact that some Trump supporters in the military may give him a pass on this while simultaneously screaming Benghazi out of the other side of their mouth. That, of course, being that attack on an American embassy that sort of became a rallying cry on the American right, where some members of that embassy were killed. So obviously a huge political controversy that folks are talking about and sucking a lot of the oxygen out of the room in D.C., I would wager there.
Yeah. I was seeing a couple of other stories that have been moving this morning, and you probably picked up on these too. The European Union is formalizing its reopening, but they're barring travelers from the United States. There are some 15 countries that the EU will open its borders to. The U.S. not on the list there. Neither is Russia or Brazil. Three of which have seen big spikes in coronavirus cases. Mm-hmm. And another story, Supreme Court striking down limits on state aid to religious schools.
Yeah, that one getting a lot of attention as well. That could have some huge ramifications. Yeah, on our group chat here among the producers, one of our producers, Jill Ament, was noting that that could have some big ramifications when the Texas legislature returns in the early spring here, as we just heard you and Ross Ramsey discuss. You know, another bit of coronavirus news noted that Greg Abbott today suspended elective surgeries in four counties in the Rio Grande Valley there, Cameron, Hidalgo, Nueces, and Webb counties. This comes after he suspended elective surgeries at hospitals in the state's largest counties, Travis, Bear, Dallas, and Harris County. So obviously being done to free up that extra hospital capacity as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to wreak havoc in Texas cities.
I know a lot of people are paying attention to Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is testifying on Capitol Hill about the coronavirus, which is surging in some 30 states right now. Lamar Alexander, who's a Republican senator from Tennessee, called on President Trump to wear a mask to try to get over that partisan divide that seems to have sprung up. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues at texasstandard.org. Till tomorrow, I'm David Brown, along with the rest of the team, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.